Do I need it?
It's been a little long over on the side of the table.
You're like, no, it's not.
Yikes, my water's leaking.
You should do it. For sure. But there's a whole bunch of
them. That's what I need. I need
Okay, I'm going to call to order the Energy, Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee meeting for Tuesday, April 8th. And the business before us today is to interview PUC members, commissioners, and actually they have all been seated for a period of time now, and we have just had a number of bills that needed to meet deadline. And so we decided to take those up before we took up the Public Utility Commissioner's confirmation. We also have a couple of reports that we are going to hear about. And also tomorrow we will be meeting to hear a report on, what is the one on tomorrow? Oh, on transmission issues, which is a very large report and will take up the entire committee hearing. So I'd like to start by asking Commissioners David Boyd, Phyllis Rhea, and Dennis O'Brien to come up to the table. Commissioner Rhea is here for a reappointment, has served for 6 years, more than 6 years, and Commissioner Boyd has been serving since last June, and Commissioner O'Brien, I believe, has been serving for a couple of months at this point in time. So I'd like to welcome you each to the committee. Committee members should have information on each of the commissioners before you. And I would like to start just by asking each of the commissioners to share a little bit about yourself and why it is you're interested in serving on the Public Utilities Commission, and if there's anything about the position that you think we should know about or about what your goals are. And I think I'll start with Commissioner Rhea.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Phyllis Rhea, and I have been a member of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission since 2001. I was originally appointed by Governor Ventura. I sit in a seat of the Democrat, and I had the pleasure of being reappointed by Governor Pawlenty last June 22nd for a second 6-year term, pending confirmation here today. I've put in quite a number of years on issues related to energy and telecom. I was an administrative law judge for over 20 years for the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings, where I was in the complex case unit that did the hearings on utility, environment, energy, telecom cases, but held hearings on a wide variety of cases that came before the office. I also headed up the mediation division of the Office of Administrative Hearings and did a lot of mediation during that period of time. Since I've been on the commission, one of the focuses that I have spent a great deal of my time on has been in the area of energy efficiency and renewable energy. I think there have been, during my tenure, a lot of legislative mandates, and the legislature has delegated quite a bit of the implementation decisions to the commission, and we have been looking at these responsibilities for quite some time. For example, the commission has been looking at off-ramps to deal with some of the concerns of these issues. I think Minnesota is seen as a national leader in the area of renewable energy efficiency, and technology. To maintain our leadership, I think these mandates have to be quickly but very carefully interpreted, and the implementation parameters have to be carefully thought through to ensure their success. And I think we need people on the commission with experience to dig into these issues in a very thoughtful way. We need commissioners who understand these issues and have the skills and confidence to move the state forward in a careful and clear way on these mandates. And I believe that I bring experience and skill to the commission, on especially with respect to these issues. And I think that my experience on the commission, now that I've been there for a while, that experience is in place, and hopefully can be put to good use on behalf of the citizens of the state of Minnesota. So I look forward to serving another 6 years, pending your approval. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Boyd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm cut out of a piece of cloth that's perhaps a little different than some who come to the commission. I come with a scientific background, not a particularly political or connected type of background. I have bachelor's degrees in both biology and chemistry and a doctorate in inorganic chemistry. I spent the previous 18 years teaching at the University of St. Thomas, the last six as chair of my department. And my sense is that, or my feeling is, my scientific and administrative skills are going to be a good fit to the commission. I leave it to my colleagues who are watching around me whether that's really true or not. I'm also interested in the challenges of learning something new, the multidisciplinary approach that goes with regulation. I'm very eager to pick up on some of those sorts of things. I was appointed last July and started, I think I started on a Tuesday and sat in on the first commission meeting on a Thursday. Tried to dive in and have been devouring bits and pieces of information as I went along. My interest in the work of the commission stems from my research agenda at the university. I've spent a number of years trying to investigate the basic science of solar energy in two different forms. One, the question of whether we can use water, sunlight, and a catalyst to create hydrogen gas and oxygen gas, a nice potential fuel for the future. And also looking to improve the efficiency of photovoltaic devices. That interest in energy and a desire to serve in a slightly different capacity are the things that prompted me to come to the commission. The work of the commission, in my sense, is that it's shifted in recent years to an increasingly technological set of questions. The commission, I think, is better by having a little bit of diversity in background, a little diversity in opinion and experience, and it's my hope that I can add some technological muscle to the commission, and leave it, again, to my colleagues to decide whether that's happened so far or not. I look forward. By the way, I'm filling the last 2 years of a term. Due to a resignation, and my colleagues at the university have been kind enough to provide me with a leave of absence in that time. So I do appreciate their patience and support while I'm here trying to do a little bit of good for the citizens of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. And Commissioner O'Brien.
Madam Chair, good afternoon. My name is Dennis O'Brien. I grew up in South Minneapolis in a little 1,400-square-foot home. There were seven kids. Five of us are lawyers. I graduated from the University of Minnesota, the University of Minnesota Law School, and went to work for the Attorney General staff in the late 1960s. I've been in private practice from 1969 until about a year ago, principally representing government. In addition to being on the Attorney General staff, I did legislative work for 14 years from 1969 to 1983, principally in school finance. I am one of the handful of people in the state that understands the intricacies of school finance. I had the privilege to try the school finance case. I've represented schools, cities, counties, principally in labor relations, throughout my practice, so I've literally been involved in public policy, and I have a passion for it. I believe that I can contribute to the continued development of sensible energy policy. I could tell you that in the a little over 2 months that I've been on the commission, that it is a good group of people. We are working together well as a team. Interesting, challenging issues. I was telling my wife a couple of weeks ago that's by far and away the best job I've ever had. It's so interesting intellectually to understand these complex issues. And so what I bring to bear is public policy, a passion for public policy, a working knowledge of how state government operates, how local government operates, and how to move big systems. That's who I am, and that's what I hope to do.
Thank you. I was thinking about your family and five attorneys coming together at a family event and what those are like. I remember I was from a family of half Republicans and half Democrats, and when we got together, we would debate for hours and hours and hours. So I can't imagine what it's like in your family.
I'm afraid I'm the only Republican in my family. The rest are all Democrats.
Are there questions of the commissioners?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Olsen.
I guess I would just like to thank you folks for taking time and meeting with us. I think it was very appropriate and nice to be able to have some time to talk about your perspectives and where you'd like our state to go, and as we are leading the nation in alternative energy. So thank you for doing that.
I do have a question. One of the things that's been brought to my attention is that that you are not able to get together and talk with one another about any docketed issues. And I think a lot of what I do is talk over with my colleagues about different issues so that I can become better informed and understand different perspectives on issues. And so I'm wondering how that affects your decision-making if you're not able to talk with one another other than in a public setting about the issues that come before you. And is there anybody that would like to take a stab at answering that?
Well, Madam Chair,
I'll
take a stab at that. I think the question can be framed as, does the open meeting law work for the commission? Can they make good public policy decisions with the open meeting law that's applicable to it? And when I first came aboard in 2001, I found it a bit frustrating and disconcerting that I wasn't able to dialogue with my fellow commissioners, because having come from the administrative court where we sat individually as administrative law judges on cases, I very often talked to my colleagues about the case and hit it around and discussed the intricacies of the case, and I wasn't able to do that. I want to say that I think there are great benefits to the open meeting law, especially in Minnesota that has, I think, such open and transparent government. And I think it's generally a very, very positive thing. I think it encourages public confidence in the process. For the citizens to know that decisions that are impacting their lives are not being made behind closed doors and smoke-filled rooms and things of that nature. But there are occasions, I think, that it would be beneficial to be able to talk together with others. So, for example, there are many very large, complex dockets that are referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings, where I used to work, for an administrative law judge to conduct a detailed litigation, if you will, and evaluates testimony and evidence and documents and so forth, and then spends a great deal of time on that docket and makes detailed findings of fact, conclusions of law, and a recommendation to the commission. And the commission, in those circumstances, is sitting very much like an appellate court. Just like our Court of Appeals, and a huge record is plopped on their desk, and they are to decipher this and be able to then go into an open meeting and render a decision on very, very complex issues. And it's difficult to do that on your own, even with the assistance of staff, and see all the perspectives from all the different points of view that are on the commission. And oftentimes it has a bit of a chilling effect when you have to do it in an open meeting to ask those very difficult questions. Let's say if you are taking a minority view, but you know you don't know exactly how you're going to vote on that, you don't want to ask questions that may then impinge your ability to be successful if the matter is appealed later in court, for example. And so there's a bit of a chilling impact. And then also, we haven't been that close to the record that you don't want to ask. You may not be able to articulate the kinds of questions that you want to ask. And so I think in those limited circumstances, when there are those checks and balances of a due process proceeding where there were there was a trial-type proceedings and there's evidence in the record on the four corners and you're bound by the four corners of that record, that it might serve the interests of the public to allow the commissioners to deliberate in private and hash things through and look at the different angles and see it from different perspectives and then go ahead in the open meeting and make that decision. So that's just some of my observations. I certainly wouldn't. There are other jurisdictions, other commissions in other states, very similar to ours, that deliberate in private. And I don't know how many jurisdictions there are that do it. I can name several that do deliberate on those kinds of circumstances as a court, as an appellate court, and they're very successful. I can think of Vermont as one, Maryland as one, and I think Iowa, Wisconsin has some variation of the open meeting process that we have where there's some room for deliberation in a private setting. I haven't done an analysis of all those jurisdictions, and I think Vermont, for one, has a specific legislative exemption that's narrowly designed to keep the process open sufficiently but allow that deliberation to take place on those quasi-judicial dockets. But it's something that I think might be healthy to take a look at, and as long as any exemptions of any kind are kept narrow and we maintain that public and transparent process to a great extent, which I think is healthy.
Commissioner Rio, do you know what the proportion of public utility commissions, state public utility commissions are that have open meeting laws as to not having open meeting laws?
I don't know the answer to that question. I know we were discussing it with staff, and I would assume that it's probably a smaller percentage that has private deliberations than most, but I'm sure that information is available somewhere, and we could find it and get it to the committee if you would like us to do that.
And Commissioner Rear, you're not prohibited, though, from talking to one other member, is that correct?
We're not. We can have one-on-one discussions, but what happens is that you're reluctant to do that because on any given agenda day, there may only be three commissioners. One might be on vacation or one might be at another meeting or unavailable for whatever reason or sick. And so you're very, very reluctant to have those kinds of discussions because what happens if when it comes to the agenda meeting you've had a discussion and there are only three commissioners there, you'd have to cancel that docket and put it off to another time, and sometimes there are time constraints on a lot of these issues. So there's very little communication and hitting off on issues with your colleagues on the commission.
Okay. I know the other two commissioners are newer to this process. I don't know if you have any insight or wish to share any feelings about that, but
Madam Chair, just briefly,
Commissioner
Boyd. Coming out of an environment where interacting with your colleagues is the norm day in and day out, it was a kind of a lifestyle changing experience to get to the commission. Your question, does our system now work? It most certainly does. Might another system work a little more efficiently in certain circumstances? Possibly. There's definitely an art to this deliberation. It's an acquired skill. I think we've all learned to do it. If the question is whether we could explore another model for certain limited purposes, I think it would be worth looking at. But
well, if we have a hole in our schedule next year, it might be worth having a discussion about this. Commissioner O'Brien, did you want to share anything?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was simply going to say that I've literally advised public bodies for decades on open meeting law, so I'm familiar with it. And we can live in that world. It retards the learning curve. I mean, I have to figure this stuff out by myself and with staff. It's hard to talk about it with commissioners because we're reluctant to do that. So the learning curve just doesn't move along as quickly as it otherwise would, but I think. I mean, that's at least been my experience.
Okay. You know, I'd also like to recognize Berlhar, who is the executive secretary to the commission, and also Commissioner Leroy Copendreyer. And then Commissioner Pugh is the other commissioner who is, I do not see out here in the audience. So, Senator Dibble, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did. It's along the same lines as your question, Madam Chair, but it has to do with conversation with the legislature. Mr. Boyd and I had a little bit of this conversation when we met, and I apologize to the other two. I had to cancel, but thank you for attempting to meet with me. I appreciate that. I know that there are also significant constraints on ex parte discussions. But you know, especially around energy policy, it's very fast moving right now. A lot going on. The legislature relies very, very heavily on the PUC for a lot of different things. We kick a lot of stuff over to the PUC, and Secretary Haar does a great job, but. I'm just wondering, do any of you have any thoughts about how we might create a little more interaction? I mean, we may be coming up with the world's best ideas or the world's worst ideas vis-a-vis the PUC, or maybe we're not even thinking about anything, you know, something that we're completely leaving out of our thinking and as we craft our policies. So, and it just feels like we see you once, and that's kind of it. I mean, we do see your staff, but... you know, I'm just wondering if there are opportunities there, because I think it might be good.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I may as well fill in the conversation for other folks. In meeting actually with several of you, I made the observation that we may have through our actions as commissioners information or experience models from other parts of the country that might be well-suited to the deliberations that you take up as legislators. And the question I posed was, is this something of value? And second was, how do we do it? Because I don't really understand the mechanics of the interaction between the bodies. To the extent it can be done, I think it would be quite valuable. If we can be of service as you craft legislation, ultimately it ends up making our jobs easier, I think, in the long run. How it's done, when it's done, I would leave to you to consider.
So we could invite you to come to our office to discuss something.
Madam Chair, only two at a time, though.
Okay. I'm not docketed items. Yeah.
I agree with Commissioner Boyd, and we're more than happy, Madam Chair, to come before your committee or meet with you individually. We are kept abreast of the legislation that is pending each session by Dr. Haar, and we do provide input to him that then is communicated to the committee from or your staff. But we're more than happy to participate in any committee meetings or individual meetings with you and share whatever knowledge you would like to hear.
I'd also like to draw your attention to this three-page handout that was generated as a result of the energy legislation we passed last year and some of the requirements that were passed on to the Public Utilities Commission, and it gives us the status of several of those measures that came out of that energy policy that was passed. Commissioner Rosen, or Commissioner Senator Rosen.
I've increased. I'm sorry, I wasn't here for the whole thing, but I'd first like to thank Commissioner Coppendreyer for his years of service, and I wish you the best of luck. You look great, and thank you very much for all your hard work in this area. And I just wanted to say, too, I think what Senator Bibble said about bill, but we do need to know the workings and how this bill happened. What we did last year is quite aggressive. It's a great mistake. We can get full cooperation, not that you have not wanted to cooperate, but just to get the correct information so we can move forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
Commissioner, I
Commissioner's good. You know, maybe
there's
some hope for Senator Rosen and I to become commissioners at some point. But, you know, as I'm looking through the qualifications now, I don't mean to, you know, make one person rise above another. But, you know, Commissioner Boyd, for me, I'm looking through publications and things and all this neat chemistry stuff. And I'm going, I think I'll be calling him a lot because this is exciting for a guy like me that loves chemistry and biology. And, but I think in terms of the qualifications and the abilities, I met with all three of them, both past and present members. I think we have not probably utilized their abilities and been able to feel free to call upon them to and even one at a time, to help us through some of these things. So I think it's very good to have them here and have that discussion, vet that out a little bit, because I think we need to do a lot more of that as we move forward on some of these energy issues that can be controversial on either end. So I'm excited. I think we got good people here, and we've had good people in the past, and we just haven't utilized them to their full ability, I think, and maybe shame on us, but we won't let that opportunity pass in the future.
If there aren't any other questions or comments, I need motions to recommend each of the commissioners for confirmation.
One at a time.
Senator Carlson.
Are you looking for one at a time?
One at a time, please.
I move Commissioner, Madam Chair and Commissioners, I move Commissioner Phyllis Reha, my constituent, for appointment.
Okay. Senator Carlson moves that that the committee recommend the appointment of Commissioner Rhea as a Public Utilities Commissioner be confirmed. Any discussion on that? All those in favor, then, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. Senator Youngbar.
I like that commissioner idea. That's all right. Madam Chair, I would move the acceptance of Commissioner Boyd to be moved along as a confirmation
okay.
on this committee. Approved for confirmation. However that motion is supposed to be.
Senator Youngbar moves that the committee recommend that the appointment of David Boyd as a public utility commissioner be recommended or be confirmed. Any discussion on that? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion adopted. Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Commissioner Dennis O'Brien be...
Senator Rosen moves that the committee recommend that the appointment of Dennis O'Brien as a public utility commissioner be confirmed. Any discussion? Mm-hmm. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. Thank you, commissioners.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Next on our agenda would be the presentation of the carbon capture and sequestration report. And I misspoke earlier. There is not a report that will be presented on transmission tomorrow, but there will be a discussion about transmission and informational hearing at that time tomorrow.
What is this now?
We've got reports.
Carbon capture and sequestration.
Okay. Okay. So who would like to begin? Mr. Lindquist?
Madam Chair, I would like to do that. My name is Mark Lindquist. I am the Energy and Biofuels Program Manager within the department.
I'm going to ask you to bring that microphone just up a little bit. It's
Better?
And speak just a little closer.
Okay. My name is Mark Lindquist. I am the Biofuels Program Manager for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And we were appropriated last session some $475,000 to contract with the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota Geological Survey to conduct two studies on the capture and storage of carbon dioxide, one on terrestrial mechanisms using plants and biotic communities to do so, and one to inject carbon dioxide into deep reservoirs in the mid-continent drift. We did execute those contracts with the Water Resources Center at the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota Geological Survey to do those studies. The reports were completed and submitted to the chairs of the appropriate committees on February 1st. As instructed by statute, and we have a variety of findings, and Cheryl Miller is here to present on the terrestrial carbon sequestration study, and along, if there are additional questions, some of the technical researchers are also available in the room to answer some of those, being Drs. Ed Nader, Sarah Hobby, and Cinzi Fazori. And from the Minnesota Geological Survey is Dr. Tony Runkel to present on that aspect of the report. Just one additional thing I would like to note to the committee. As we look at these issues of carbon and carbon management, the Next Gen Energy Act of last year had some fairly substantial goals for reductions of carbon dioxide. As the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group has worked and made recommendations and these studies have moved forward, the department does see and recognize that there's going to be some substantial expectations on us and how we manage land and how we account for carbon management in addition to our traditional resource management goals. And we're taking that very seriously. We're organizing our technical and scientific staff and capacity to build on the work that's been done by the U and others so that as we move forward with resource management, we're able to address these issues as part of our management. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Cheryl Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Lindquist. Ms. Miller.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Prettner-Solon, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Miller. I'm the coordinator of the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative. That's a three-year-old program based at the University of Minnesota that is an interdisciplinary forum of research, education, and stakeholder work to try to bring information to the public and to land managers and policymakers like yourself about terrestrial carbon sequestration. This project was initiated in about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. Initial funding from the Initiative on Renewable Energy and Environment at the University, and has had a number of other private foundation and public government funders. It also has a task force that includes many representatives of many of the state government agencies, NGOs, and business groups that have a real interest in carbon sequestration in this state. As probably everybody on this committee knows, terrestrial carbon sequestration is the absorption and conversion of atmospheric carbon dioxide, CO2, by plants and converted into plant tissue, bark, leaves, etc. Because of its ability to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and store it in vegetative form, it's been proposed as an important strategy for slowing the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and therefore combating climate change. So this initiative has been very interested in, is that true, and what possible strategies could be applied here in Minnesota? What particular kinds of practices, land use changes, land cover changes or practices would be most applicable to our ecoregion and rural economies? What the size of the contribution that carbon sequestration could make to a greenhouse gas reduction program in the state? What would it cost? What would be some ancillary co-benefits of doing that? And what are some of the policy implications? So those are a lot of the kinds of questions that we like to dig in to ask and work with researchers at the university to try to develop answers for. The report that I'm going to talk about in very summary form for you is one of the foundational pieces, we believe, for this work. It is a state of the science, if you will, on terrestrial carbon sequestration, what is known from empirical studies that have been done primarily in the United States and this region about different kinds of carbon sequestration practices and what is the result of that. So I have provided you with a handout, looks like that. Got some leaves on the top. And I'll just walk through some of these findings for you. One of the key findings is that Minnesota, no surprise to anyone, has very large carbon stocks across all ecosystems, forests, wetlands, agricultural areas, grasslands, etc. The highest concentrations by far, however, are in forest lands and particularly in peatlands, where carbon has been accumulating low these last 10,000 or so years. Those two ecosystems, peatlands and forests, are highlighted in this report as very important to try to protect so that they do not re-emit the CO2, the carbon that they're now holding in the form of CO2. The heart of the study is a literature review of many of the different kinds of land management practices, land use changes that could be undertaken in this area, particularly to enhance carbon sequestration rates in areas where sequestration could be increased if you change the land practices or land uses. And that primarily occurs on agricultural lands. By converting agricultural lands to different kinds of more perennial or larger woody crops, in many cases you can sequester more carbon. You can capture, there's a greater capacity and greater rates of sequestration. On the back of the handout is is the practices and land use changes that the research group looked at, believing that these are the ones most important to this area because of the land scale that they have in Minnesota, and also because of their sequestration abilities. The right, far right-hand column is the CO2 carbon dioxide per acre per year that could be sequestered. And you'll see there's quite a range of rates through these different land uses. The columns immediately to the left of that one is called level of certainty. And it is tries to indicate the level of scientific confidence that we know these rates are within the range of how accurate they are. So you will also see a wide range of confidence levels in some of these numbers. And that is kind of one of the natures of this whole enterprise, is that the science on terrestrial sequestration is still definitely an emerging science. There is much to know, and so this report tries to capture what we have some level of certainty, what is uncertain, what are the factors affecting all of that, and bring that before you. Third finding is that if we undertook developed strategies for increasing carbon sequestration, the ability of land to take up carbon, we could use any number of many scenarios. In this report, we did three illustrative scenarios. One was on biofuels. How could we align a biofuel program in this state with a carbon sequestration? If we converted agricultural row crops to perennial grass systems, for instance, that would increase sequestration, and it would that could be one strategy. Converting lands to short rotation woody crops could also be a major sequester of carbon at the same time that it's producing a biofuel. We did another scenario that is very diversified, kind of environmentalist dream program of many different kinds of reforestation, marginal lands put into buffers, restorations of wetlands, and different kinds of long-lived and, perennial systems. Different scenarios, you can play around with them as much as you want, and what we were trying to do was see if we could come up with any plausible scenarios for how to achieve something in the range of a 10% wedge of CO2 reduction targets in the future. The state policy is now set to bring down carbon emissions by 45 million metric tons in the year 2025. And we wanted to see if terrestrial sequestration could provide a 10% wedge of that reduction. So, and there are, in fact, many, many plausible ways that we could do it with reforestation or any of the number of practices that are here. And at one point, we tried to work out a little game that we could provide you all so you could calculate it yourself, and decided we probably shouldn't do that. It might backfire on us. But basically, the idea is by 2025, if we ramped up, that we could provide modest contributions to the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals, we believe. We think that this could be done at the same time that it could also be providing some important environmental flood protection, water quality protection, particularly important in an era of changing climate. Could be very important. So the recommendations that derive from all that, or kind of the policy considerations to bring to you, is we think it's very important for the state policymakers, leaders to realize the importance of the existing carbon stocks here, particularly peatlands. There is a rising sense of urgency around the world about peatland destruction and forest destruction and its contributions to CO2. And because Minnesota has such a very large 5.5 million acres of peatlands in this state, a drying climate, a warming climate could present very serious consequences to those carbon stocks. And if they would start to re-emit CO2, we would be in a world hurt. We would have to really figure out where we were going to cut other places. So protect, doing what we can, being aware and starting to think about how we're going to protect peatlands and forests in a changing climate, we believe is very important. Second, we think that there are many programs already existing that carbon sequestration could be joined with, could be integrated with. Biofuels programs, renewable energy programs, many different kinds of conservation programs and other sustainable development things. The state has many programs on both public and private lands that either already are sequestering carbon and just could be expanded, or with very minor considerations, tweaks, whatever, could have a larger role in sequestering carbon. And third is that we think that in order to scale all this up to the level where it would make a significant contribution over the next 20 years, that we really need to develop better science, better public confidence that this is an important thing to be doing, that this is a reasonable place to be putting some state resources. And in order to do that, we think that we need to continue to build an infrastructure of monitoring, scientific research, and demonstration on the ground of these kinds of programs, activities. So the third recommendation, and that is something that our task force is just getting underway, really, is to develop a more detailed kind of recommendations and plans for what a monitoring network and demonstration projects around the state should look like in order to provide the information that's needed. So with that, I could take questions.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Miss, is it Dr. Miller?
No, it's Ms. Yep.
Ms. Miller. will you be coming back to us with your further recommendations? Because my question was, what do we do with this information now? Is there enough information? Will it be communicated, like, I don't know, to Commerce or to the Department of Energy? Will it be provided in a way that we can use these recommendations to decrease our to sequester our carbon? And is there a way for you to prioritize so that we know what carbon sequestration methods perhaps have the highest economic benefit?
Madam Chairman, the first stage report was the scientific work, and then there will be a second report that will for you that will lay out more next steps and what the implications of this in terms of how to set up this infrastructure that I just talked about. So yes, and there are policy questions, policy recommendations will be included in that. So that the answer for that is yes. Now, priority practices. We have been discussing at length how to now start approaching which practices have the most importance. And I think the thinking is that identifying those programs, first of all, protecting what we have. Everyone's very agreed that we have to figure out ways to protect existing peatlands and forests. Take that into consideration in managing them. And second is figure out how those practices that have high sequestration value and high certainty of their positive benefits should be encouraged through by bringing them into existing programs. As we see how those work and how they perform, then, you know, be able to continue to ramp them up. The other program, the other activities that we don't have such a good scientific understanding of yet, we need to keep looking at, because we don't want to convert everything to short rotation woody crops. That we know. That is a very high sequesterer, but putting that all over the state would have very negative implications for other environmental services. So wrestling that out, we're trying to look at a eco-regional approach to some of this. What in different regions are going to be the sequestration options that are going to have the greatest value? We're just starting to think about that. So we will be coming back to you in the next this summer with further reports.
So we will have that ready for us for the next legislative session then?
Yes, ma'am.
And did you say that you had figured out that you could decrease carbon by 10% by 2025? Is that correct?
That is the goal. That is kind of the target we were shooting for, and the scenarios that we developed, and they're in the report, and I didn't bring them in any detail, but the biofuels one was a combination of short rotation woody crops, perennial grasses, and cover crops could reduce CO2 by 3 million metric tons per year, and that's about 6% of what you're trying to achieve by 2025. And we're saying 2025 because we think we need time to get this all moving.
Okay.
The one that is more diversified and has larger, it sort of depends on how much the state wants to invest in this as a strategy. But that one has much higher acreages that are put into, you know, a new CREP, a sequestration CREP, you know, and reforestation programs. And that one, you know, worked out, our little scenario worked out to 13%. So 6 to 13% were a few of the scenarios we worked on. The other scenario we worked on is if we were losing 5,000 acres of forest and 1,000 acres of peatlands a year, we would wipe all that out. They are such huge sources of potential sources of CO2. That if we would do all these good things but continue to lose forests and peatlands, it would be a wash.
But do we need to create new peatlands or forests in order to decrease the carbon or to sequester or absorb the carbon, or are you talking about existing?
Madam Chairman, I'm talking about existing. Peatlands are extremely slow. We can't create those. Reforestation programs, though, are of major interest, whether it's urban forestry or forestry of various kinds.
But are existing peatlands any solution for further reduction in carbon emissions?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I don't
understand. I'm not saying that correctly. Are the existing peatlands, are they useful in sequestering further carbon, or are they already functioning in that capacity?
Madam Chairman, they are already functioning in that capacity, and there is, I believe, not a lot we can or could do to make them sequester carbon faster. They are important in terms of preserving existing carbon stocks. I could refer this question, however, to Dr. Nader, who is an expert on this topic.
Okay. Dr. Nader?
The existing peatlands contain substantial amounts of carbon, which has been accreted over 5 to 10,000 years. And what we're trying to do is protect them so that is not re-emitted to the atmosphere at some later point in time.
Before you go on, just give us your name for the record, please.
My name is Dr. Ed Nader. Thank you.
Okay.
And the What we're trying to do is protect them so they won't emit. If they are dried out, they will start to decompose and emit CO2 back to the atmosphere. If they are mined, things like that. They currently do sequester small amounts of carbon, but they are already considered in our current carbon budget for the state, and so they are not considered part of the solution per se. We are looking at restoring some peatlands in our study, and in particular prairie potholes, but that is a separate issue from this one, from the protection issue. And I wanted to clarify that the 10% that Cheryl was talking about in here is 10% of the reduction, not 10% of the current emissions. We're looking at more like 4.5% of the current emissions.
Okay.
Being able to accomplish that.
Okay. Senator Olsen.
Thank you. One of my concerns, you know, with your talk about conversion from row crops is that with commodity prices such as they are today, I think it's going to be hard to get farmers to take land out of production unless there's a pretty good incentive for them to do that. But my question would be, as we're looking at like cellulosic ethanol and devise the enzyme that can do that efficiently, if we have, say, a hybrid popple forest and that's growing for 7 years and it's harvested, does it still sequester the carbon and then as it grows back again? I mean, can you rotate these crops, you know, like prairie grasses and stuff, by harvesting them? Does that affect the sequestration rate that they would have?
It affects,
Dr. Nader?
Yes, it affects the calculations of the budget. If you burn that and convert it back to the atmosphere, then you would lose that CO2 again. So there's a concern about what the life is after, what the half-life is of the carbon afterwards. However, if you're using it as a biofuel and you're offsetting potential emissions of a fossil fuel, then there's a different sort of calculation for that.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to whoever can answer the question, I sat through the House meeting on the California emission standards last night, but I got to talk to a number of biofuels people afterwards. And other states are looking at the use of fruits for biofuels, obviously, because it's sugar-based to begin with. You're not looking at the whole area to use your enzyme reaction or other to switch starch to sugar before you make the ethanol. And I thought that was interesting because a friend of mine and I had run calculations on running apple, growing apples to ethanol in terms of, I guess I got to go the long way around it, but our calculations were that if you switched from corn to apples that you get twice the production of apples per acre that you would corn, that on average in Minnesota you might get just north of 7,000 pounds of corn and you'd get north of 15,000 pounds of apples per acre. Obviously, as the apple trees mature, you have an ever-increasing ability to sequester carbon below grade as well as above grade, and other states are looking at that kind of a thing to potentially offset or change some of the ethanol to fruit trees. Have we looked at that kind of thing in Minnesota?
Dr. Nader?
We have not looked at that specifically. We were interested principally in direct carbon sequestration as opposed to biofuels. We were looking at potential mixes of the two, but that was one that we did not have any data on.
Yeah. Senator Jungbar.
Madam Chair and Dr. It just seems like as we're looking at prairie grasses and their potential as well, if we're going to harvest them for biofuels, that we need to look at other alternatives that are long-term growth factors and, I believe, exponentially sequester carbon dioxide and use it as we're creating those things as well. So hopefully we'll look at that kind of thing like other states are looking at as well and factor that in.
We will.
As a potential. Doesn't work everywhere, but.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, I guess my question is, are we going to need a follow-up study if we change land usage now that we're going to have for economic impacts? We're solving one problem with carbon sequestration, or is this study also going to include some of that?
Ms. Miller?
Senator Dole, Madam Chairman, this particular study does not include any of that kind of analysis. But it is important consideration. It's something that needs to be thought through. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Senator Rosen, can I have...
Ms. Miller, Dr. Nader.
Currently, most of the peatlands are preserved and are not being affected, but drainage of peatlands for specific purposes, sometimes putting roads through causes drainage of the peatlands from, or else flooding of the peatlands. But also there have been discussions of using peat for fuel, using it for other purposes. We do some mining of peatlands for horticultural peat and so forth, but in particular preventing them from being drained for specific purposes.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll move on to, is it Tony Runkle?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. My name's Anthony Runkle. I'm the Chief Geologist for the Minnesota Geological Survey, which is part of the University of Minnesota. And our project objective was to assess the potential of the Mid-Continent Rift System as a site for deep geologic sequestration of CO2. Deep geologic sequestration of CO2 is, in a general way, a very simple process. It's capturing and compressing CO2 at the land surface, injecting it down a borehole into the subsurface at a depth of a kilometer or greater. And the geologic conditions necessary for deep geologic sequestration include the presence of porous and permeable sandstone bodies at a depth of a kilometer or greater, and also the presence on top of those sandstone bodies of relatively impermeable shales or mudstones. And the purpose of the shales or the mudstones is to effectively hold the CO2 in place, the compressed CO2 in place in the underlying sandstone body. The only known rocks across the entire state of Minnesota that have any potential at all for deep geologic sequestration are the rocks that occur in what's known as the Mid-Continent Rift System. And there's a schematic illustration on the back of your handout, very schematic, that just shows the map distribution of the Mid-Continent Rift System. The reason the Mid-Continent Rift System is the only known geologic feature that has any potential is that it simply contains a relatively deep extent of sedimentary rocks that include sandstone and shale. What we did for our project is we compiled all known information on the Mid-Continent Rift System, not only from all across Minnesota, but in adjacent states as well, in analogous geologic settings, such as in Wisconsin, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, Iowa, and Kansas. We particularly focused on the kinds of information that would give us an indication as to whether the sandstone bodies are relatively porous and permeable, and whether those sandstone bodies will have impermeable caps on top of them at a depth of 1 kilometer or greater. In a nutshell, what we learned in analysis of all the data we compiled was that the Mid-Continent Rift System in Minnesota has properties that are far less suitable for deep geologic sequestration than other sites currently being considered around the globe today. What I'll do here is just very briefly run through a few key features about the Mid-Continent Rift System that are either positives or negatives in terms of its potential to serve as a site for deep geologic sequestration. What we found is the Mid-Continent Rift does indeed contain sandstone bodies, some of which at relatively shallow depths, depths too shallow for deep geologic sequestration, have modest porosity and permeability. But again, the ones we found were at depths that are inadequate for deep geologic sequestration. In addition, there are shale and mudstone beds of adequate thickness and with low enough permeability that they potentially could serve as a cap if you ignore the potential presence of fractures and faults, which I'll get to in a minute. A third positive finding is that, unlike many other states where deep geologic sequestration is being considered, Minnesota has few, if any, very deep exploration boreholes that are not sealed. And those deep unsealed boreholes in other states are a potential risk for CO2 to eventually escape, that's injected in the ground to eventually escape to the land surface. Now, on the negative side of our results, based on our analysis both in Minnesota and several holes in adjacent states, what we found is all known sandstone bodies at the depths necessary for sequestration or deeper have markedly lower porosity and permeability than what's necessary. In fact, the permeability is particularly dismal. It's orders of magnitude too low to be viable for sequestration. That is, it needs to be, in some cases, 1,000 times greater for to have the ability for CO2 to be injected into that sandstone body. Furthermore, the Mid-Continent Rift is geologically a rather what we call tectonically complex. That is, it's been pushed around and faulted and folded quite a bit compared to other sites around the country being investigated for CO2. And as a result, it's much more faulted and fractured than other sites currently being considered. And therefore, the integrity of the potential seals in the subsurface is in question. And based on the data we analyzed, in fact, we see evidence for deep saline water that exists in the Mid-Continent Rift today leaking upward in places along faults and fractures to the freshwater aquifers. And a risk then with CO2 injection, at least locally, is that the same thing would happen along those same faults and fractures with the injected CO2. Our conclusions then are that currently available data indicate that the Mid-Continent Rift has only a very small probability in terms of its potential to be a viable host for deep geologic sequestration. We would like to add, however, that there are very few very deep holes in the rift in Minnesota. So we regard the information we used to make this conclusion as somewhat limited. And if a higher degree of confidence were desired, we laid out or we did some investigation into what potential follow-up studies would involve, and we're looking at potentially on the orders of tens to hundreds of millions of dollars of follow-up work to drill some deep boreholes, investigate further the properties of the Mid-Continent Rift, and we believe even with that additional data, the probability is still small that sequestration sites in the rift will ever be deemed viable. Thank you.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how does this work, like in Canada, where they're injecting it into oil fields? Is that because there's already holes there and it's just kind of filling a gap? Or
Dr. Runkle.
Madam Chair. Senator, in the places where deep geologic CO2 sequestration is currently taking place, such as the oil fields of Canada and offshore in Norway, these are they're injecting CO2 into what are known to be very porous and permeable sandstone bodies. And that's a key feature that we have not yet identified in the Mid-Continent Rift system. Virtually any rock can have the holes installed for injection. It's a matter of whether the rock will accept the injected material at an efficient rate.
Dr. Runkle, what's the closest spot where geological sequestration could be used?
Madam Chair, both North Dakota and Illinois are leading efforts to conduct pilot studies into deep geologic sequestration. To be honest with you, I have to express some ignorance on the distance to the sites in each of those states, but I'll just briefly describe both states for you. They would be the closest areas. In Illinois, they're looking at a site in what's called the Illinois Basin, where they're going to inject CO2 to a depth of, I believe, about 5,000 feet into what's called the Mount Simon Sandstone. We have that same sandstone here in Minnesota at a much shallower depth. It's the Mount Simon, as well as other sandstones in the Illinois Basin, are some of those most porous and permeable sandstones known in the world, actually. And so geologically, and it's also a very simple structural setting. So geologically, they just happen to be blessed with conditions that are deemed practically ideal based on our current understanding of how deep geologic sequestration might work, practically ideal for this kind of thing. North Dakota has most of the same things going for it with just different rock names, different formation names. And in addition, some of the sites North Dakota is investigating will also potentially enhance oil recovery. So economically, it can also make better sense in the North Dakota scenario.
So you keep talking about this as being porous. I would think that if it had high porosity, that it could, there would be the chance that it could escape.
There's always that chance it can escape, but that's why you need two key factors. You need to find that porous sandstone body. Sedimentary rock layers are commonly alternate between, say, sandstone, shale. You find your porous sandstone, and what you want immediately on top of that is a shale that's relatively impermeable, and that will hold it in place. You also then need what we call kind of a structural closure. The rocks need to be bent a little bit, so in essence, you have a big balloon injected CO2 held in place by this impermeable cap.
So as we look at places like Illinois or North Dakota where there is the potential for this type of sequestration, I'm assuming that would be pretty costly, first of all, to transport that far. But what type of capacity is there? Are they already being used up by those states, or will they be used up by those states, or is it something that Minnesota could invest in?
Madam Chair, I'll answer your question, but I need to preface it by saying this is extending a little bit out of my area of expertise. My understanding is that they have far more room than they have emissions in those states. And therefore, no, the answer to the first part of your question is yes, there would be adequate room for other states to say, transport over there. Where this particularly gets out of my area of expertise is cost of pipelines and things like that, and feasibility of say, 1,000-kilometer pipelines. I know those kinds of issues are investigated, both the economics and the engineering aspects of it. Again, I'm not an expert, but what I've also heard most recently is what might be more practical and what might instead happen is kind of I'm not sure this is the right term, but a carbon trade, some kind of trade system. For instance, at a recent meeting with the North Dakota group, they responded to one of my questions by saying, why would you spend $1 billion on a pipeline to North Dakota when you can just pay us to inject more of our CO2 into the ground? Does that answer your question, Madam Chair?
Yes. Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I had similar questions to yours again.
Like
the pipeline question and the capacity. So when we're talking about, I have two questions that kind of relate to what happens when we stick it down in the ground. One is, in what form do we put the CO2 in the ground? Is it still gaseous or is it in liquid form?
It's called supercritical. Mm-hmm. It's more liquid than it is gas, but it's neither, as I understand it.
Sounds like a politician's answer.
I apologize.
It's everything and nothing. It's whatever you want it to be. And then when we talk about how much room there is, over what period of time? Do we fill these reservoirs up eventually and then we have to go hunt around and find another one?
Dr. Ronald.
I just have no sense of how big these things are and how much CO2 they take.
Madam Chair, Senator, again, because we focus so much on the conditions just in Minnesota, I don't want to profess to be an expert on reservoir capacity continent-wide, but the numbers that come to mind based on kind of the general reading I did is that there's potentially adequate storage space continent-wide in deep saline formations that could, I believe I've read, account for emissions for many decades and perhaps centuries is what I've read.
Interesting.
But that doesn't take into consideration of where you have to go, you know, how far you have to move it to
right.
get it in the ground and that kind of thing.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you. When we're talking about the injection, is it like when you drill a well, do you have to blast a cavity down at 5,000 feet so that when the gas is or the liquid is injected down there, there's time for it to go into the rock formation? Or how does that work?
Dr. Ronkel.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm reluctant to say once again I'm not an expert on something, especially as a scientist, but I'm not an expert on the engineering aspects of how these sites work. My understanding is based in part on the porosity and permeability of a formation. Say it's relatively low but still viable. An individual site will then have a relatively large number of injection wells, all cased and grouted, so to speak, down past the impermeable cap to, and then open through a large extent of the porous sandstone body. And then through computer models, they can determine at any individual well through the injection process how far the plume or how far the plume essentially of CO2 would move from any one well, and then come up with a pattern of wells at the site that would allow the geologic site to eventually be fully encompassed or basically become a filled reservoir of supercritical CO2, if that answers your question.
Any further questions or comments? Well, then, thank you. I appreciate the information, and we will look forward to future reports. And thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators.
I'd like next to call on the next report will be a presentation of energy savings.
Much hope there.
And Nikki Giancola from the Department of Administration. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Nikki Giancola, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Administration. And on behalf of the Department of Administration, as well as the Department of Commerce, I'd just like to thank you for your time in hearing out the results of this report. It's about energy conservation activity in state government buildings. The intent here today is to provide you an overview of the State Government Energy Savings Report, which was required as part of the 2007 legislation to address the 1.5% annual energy savings goal, which was given in 216B. This report focuses on the demand side of the energy equation in state government buildings. For instance, current building and energy usage, as well as conservation strategies. The Department of Commerce contracted with the Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy at the university to conduct the research and then prepare the report that you have before you today. Through a series of survey questions, face-to-face interviews, and a roundtable sort of forum with energy subject matter experts from state agencies, MNSCU, and the U of M, the center compiled the background information on energy use and savings in government buildings and use that to address the questions that are asked by law and the legislature. The report also, as required in the 2007 legislation, identified the barriers that currently exist and offers some recommendations to address them. I don't think any of us would disagree with this, that the idea of buildings being a significant consumer of energy isn't a new thing. Studies have suggested that buildings are responsible for almost half of the energy consumption in the U.S., and obviously then there's an enormous potential in terms of conservation available here, but it also requires a proportionate investment in retrofit adjustments, analysis, and design, and I think we'd all agree that action taken in this sector is critical to the overall strategy related to conservation in state buildings. So with that, I would turn it over to Steve Kelly, the director for the center. He and his team are going to provide you a bit more detail about the report.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to present the report. I'm Steve Kelly, and I'm the director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy, having been in that job for about a year now. And the context for this you are all familiar with from an overview point of view, but I want to emphasize a couple key points. Minnesota has already made an extremely good start on this going back several years with the commitment it made to setting goals in the bonding bill for energy efficiency with respect to buildings that would be provided new funds back in 2004. And we also made a commitment, and this you'll hear, I think, folks talk about this, to developing a database of all public buildings in the state that analyze them on a square footage purpose, usage, and a variety of other factors. And that tool, that database, puts Minnesota in a much better position probably than any other, certainly than any other state government in the United States, and way ahead of a lot of governments around the world in terms of our understanding of what could we could accomplish with respect to public buildings in our state. That's we made significant use of that database in understanding what was going on and making recommendations. So we've got a good head start, and the recommendations in this report, we think, will help move the state forward if the legislature decides to act on them. And we, consistent with the intention of the legislation, we stayed focused on the energy savings aspect of it, which certainly relate to tax dollars saved. But the legislature had as its sort of byproduct calculation then the carbon emissions saved. So the focus was really on energy savings, on efficiency, but then secondarily on what can we do with respect to greenhouse gas emissions as a result of this. So I'm going to introduce the two people who actually did most of the work. We were lucky to have available to work on this project Ms. Alexandra Mallett, who is in the dissertation phase of obtaining her PhD from the London School of Economics, and then research associate Dane McFarlane, who obtained his bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from the University of Minnesota and is a student in the Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy program at the Humphrey. So I will turn it over to Mr. McFarlane for the initial element of the report.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dane McFarlane. Thank you for having me. I'd first like to outline some of the methods we used for our report and our research. First of all, we went along with these parameters. The legislation was targeted at state entities. These were Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the University of Minnesota, and most of the state agencies in state government. Those agencies are specifically listed on page 2 of the report. We talked about energy savings in our report. By energy savings, we meant conservation and energy efficiency measures. We focused mainly on stationary energy sources, which are electricity and heat, rather than, say, transportation energy. And we focused on systems management versus behavior changes to focus on technical solutions, funding, and policy solutions. And finally, we used site versus sort energy, site energy being the end-use energy given to the building rather than energy generated at a power plant. For sources of information, we did a literature review which fed our online survey. The online survey was given to facilities managers and other people in energy positions at each of the state entities. After that, we did interviews and informal discussions to talk about some of the barriers and policy solutions. And finally, we did an energy savings session at the Humphrey where we presented a menu of options and found about 40 facilities managers to bring their opinions and experiences to the study. Now I'd like to talk about some of the barriers we identified in the study. They were information, organization, and resource barriers. First of all, we need to establish a baseline if we want to have specific energy targets, namely a 1.5% annual reduction. This would be a baseline energy usage in either in both electricity and heat. You could have it starting in recent years or next year. Secondly, there was an inadequacy of data for electricity and heating for all agencies and buildings. We want this policy to be long-term, so we need to formulate it to last about 15 to 20 years to achieve these total carbon and energy savings goals. There exists a diversity of buildings throughout the state at all state agencies and other entities. These buildings have different types of energy used. They have different forms of heat and are from different eras and of construction type. There's a resource scarcity in many of the facilities management sectors. There's major funding for improvements. They come from HEPR bonding appropriation, but that appropriation is historically funded only at 40 to 50% of requested funding. And many of the operating budgets are very thin for administrative tasks, and they focus on academic or department program delivery rather than energy savings. There's a communication and information challenge between state entities for sharing information on energy savings. And finally, there's an organizational inertia where there's entrenched formats of organization for us, all the agencies and their energy management. Now I'd like to outline some policies we identified that could be great starting points. First of all, there's clarifying policies. We need a standardized baseline. Each agency needs to figure out how much energy they use each year. We need verifiable energy data from each entity. These are necessary for setting the annual agency goals. Secondly, we need standardized units of measurement. There would be one for electricity, such as megawatt hours, and one for heating, which would likely be MMBTUs, which is 1 million BTUs. These are units that are used across both industry and academia in practice and in theory, and we believe megawatt hours and MMBTUs would be a great standard. Lastly, for clarifying policies, we need to clarify the method of calculating annual targets. The legislation mentions 1.5% a year, but it's not clear on whether that's an absolute target set from the baseline or whether it's compounded or linear over the years. And lastly, we need either an initial baseline or 3 to 5 year periods. The 3 to 5 year periods would allow flexibility for resetting annualized goals in light of yearly experiences. Secondly, there are some enabling policies. These are tools which will help each entity measure their annual energy. Many buildings are not metered. We need meters for each building. Some campuses had 20 to 40 buildings that were running only 1 or 2 meters for the entire campus. On the Capitol Complex loop, energy was reported for most of the Capitol buildings as one figure. As most of the energy savings measures will be building focused, we need building data rather than across all agencies. Secondly, we need new meters. New meters provide better types of data rather than archaic or old industry data. My final point would be that you cannot manage what you cannot measure. Simply giving the ability to measure energy at each state agency will foster a mindset of energy savings, where facilities managers will keep track of their energy use constantly in their minds, and that will provide a great first step to enabling energy savings over time. Now to talk about other enabling policies and some other next step, I would like to hand it over to my colleague, Alexandra Mallett. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Alexandra Mallett from the Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy. So as my colleague Dane was saying, other enabling policies that we determined through our study is, yes, it's important to measure, but you also need to finance. You also need to provide financing mechanisms. There are some existing funding sources out there, so it's important to expand them and to make use of them, but also to consider additional funding. For instance, I know that the Department of Commerce has been promoting the Minnesota Public Building Enhanced Energy Efficiency Program bill, and I understand it has been well received. There's also the Shared Energy Savings Program, which has been in existence since 1984 from CenterPoint Energy. But the challenge with some of these programs, for instance, the one that I just referred to, is that they only cover areas under the jurisdiction of CenterPoint Energy. But when you're looking at state entities, we're talking about the entire state of Minnesota. Some other suggestions are perhaps doing something similar to Minnesota's Percent for the Art program and doing the same thing for energy savings. So anytime you have new buildings being constructed or recommissioned buildings, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this term, but basically recommissioning a building is when you're fine-tuning a building. You're sort of going in and doing an overhaul of an existing building. Another alternative could be to have a fixed dollar amounts for energy savings. An interesting program out at the University of Minnesota, the Twin Cities campus, is that their facilities management team, they have a yearly budget of about $3 million specifically for energy savings projects. Maybe something like that could be replicated to MinSCU or to state government departments. Another option, which is becoming increasingly attractive actually in lots of parts of the United States and elsewhere, is this whole notion of third-party financing, or what's called energy performance contracting. And under this, basically an energy service company, or an ESCO, provides capital needed up front, and they would guarantee the energy savings. Right now, the Department of Administration manages the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program, but there have only been a few projects so far that have been completed. In addition to funding, what a lot of people were telling us is the need to have sort of one centralized hub, one sort of go-to place to get information on energy savings. As Dane was saying earlier, if we're talking about standardizing methods, technical assumptions, and what have you to create the baseline, this could be a one-stop shop where people can go to look at other programs being done, to look at what are the assumptions being made, how do they relate to at the national level, et cetera, et cetera. And they can also, maybe an idea too, this one-stop shop could have sort of a web link or something where different agencies or different campuses can sort of share experiences. And another enabling policy, what we were told, is the importance of training, I guess sort of in two aspects, the experts and then, of course, just the general employees. And so requiring training for building operators, engineers, architects, and also, too, just having seminars for actual employees just to sort of get the ball rolling, get it to energy savings as part of the institution. And the third sort of area where we saw policies is this whole notion of ensuring that they're long-term. It's important to provide consistency. In other words, we're getting there. The ball is rolling, but we need to keep the ball rolling. So what we suggested were to provide incentives. Basically, what we were told is that a lot of programming, operations, and construction decisions are carried out separately, and so it's important to integrate them to make sure that energy savings are captured. What we were told is that often it's a lot cheaper to do energy savings when buildings are being constructed rather than going in later and doing it doing retrofits. And also, too, the importance of recognition for energy savings champions. Definitely in our study, we saw some really interesting things going on. I know Winona State University, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, many, many, and the efforts of our colleagues at the Department of Administration and Department of Commerce. So maybe some sort of award system or something just to sort of say, hey, you guys are doing a great job. And also, too, we thought because many departments, buildings are very diverse, it's important to allow for flexibility to reach the energy savings goal, perhaps letting each agency or campus decide how they would best be placed to operationalize the goal. And finally, too, we're talking about energy savings, but the reality is that we are moving into a carbon-managed world, and so it's important if we're going to be looking at what sort of savings we see in dollars and energy metrics to sort of capture this whole greenhouse gas emissions. Another policy we suggested, too, is to have a group in charge of goal enforcement. While on the one hand it's very important to encourage, on the other hand it's important to ensure that these energy savings are verified, and so independent energy audits and what have you, we think is a good idea. And also to what we were told, even though we focused on systems management, at the end of the day, when you really come down to it, it's important to make it sort of part and parcel of the culture of these organizations. And so we're suggesting to institutionalize it more, to make it part of the parcel. So basically, more formal mechanisms in place, like a formal steering group and more support for the B3 database or other energy management systems. And finally, too, what we recommend is we sort of see the study as one step, an important process, and so it's important to conduct further study in this area, for instance, looking at other applicable entity, looking more at the carbon dynamic. These are just some other suggestions. So to conclude, what we found are that definitely energy savings are on the radar screen of almost all campuses and departments. Many have considered energy saving measures, and they're aware of the outside resources, but they have been unable to act on them. Basically, what we found is that definitely Minsky, U of M campuses and departments statewide, they have operating professionals that understand the need for this and the importance of doing so, but they need the legislators' help to do so. We also found, too, that the barriers we identified are not unique to Minnesota. In other studies, these information measurement, lack of resources, lack of time, the importance of training are definitely found elsewhere within the United States. As Steve was mentioning at the start, we definitely, Minnesota has a strong base to work from, and so it's important to expand this further and to build on actions that have already been taken. There are definitely people committed to energy savings. And energy savings we see as an important aspect of Minnesota's energy strategy. And basically, the money that the legislature spends now will save taxpayers' money and will definitely reduce emissions and reduce energy in the long run. So with that, I will turn over to my colleague, Steve Kelly.
Madam Chair and members, as Ms. Mallett was saying, we, in the course of doing this study, found a lot of people who are deeply committed to saving energy. But the institutional environments that they're in can sometimes inhibit that goal, and it operates at a couple levels. If the legislature is considering a bonding bill, there will be institutional pressure to having multiple buildings in a lot of different districts, and there will be then a tension with the goal of ensuring that those buildings have built into them features that make them more energy efficient. So there's a tendency to hold down some of those initial investments in energy efficiency because of the desire of delivering more product in more places. The same thing happens when an individual agency or an individual campus is designing a building to propose to you. The dean will be trying to figure out how to get one more lab into a building, and if the choice is an energy efficiency measure or the additional lab, the institutional pressures will tend to favor the lab over the energy savings feature. And so a number of the recommendations we were making were designed to help change that calculation by suggesting that you set aside money specifically for the energy savings features that would be incorporated into buildings, similar to the program that Ms. Mallett mentioned at the University of Minnesota. Iowa tries to do something similar. So we don't want to downplay the cost, the initial cost factors, but the positive side about all of this is that especially if you add the carbon cost to the energy savings cost, particularly with the increasing price of energy these days, large numbers of energy savings projects both incorporated into new buildings and retrofitted in existing buildings make economic sense in the long term. The challenge for the legislature is, can you handle taking some costs, spending some money in the short term to get those longer term gains, longer term savings? And that's a huge institutional and political challenge, not just for you, but for all these agencies that report to the state government. But the opportunity is here. You for the most part, the legislature has an ability to influence these users of energy directly compared to trying to influence power companies and consumers in the use of their energy in their homes or private businesses. We can adopt policies as a state that encourage these state-level entities to take the kinds of actions that will save significant amounts of energy. We think the potential is for energy and therefore emissions reductions of 20% to 30% in public sector buildings, and therefore setting a goal of 1.5% a year as in some kind of absolute sense over a period of 20 years does make sense. But as my colleagues have pointed out, it's important that the legislature be clear about what you mean and how it's going to be measured and provide the resources to these campuses and to the entities so that they can purchase the meters and install them, measure, and then take action on what they learn.
Well, former Senator Kelly, we should be making a report to you then, because this year we have legislation in the works that addresses many of the issues that you've been discussing here. One of them is a bill that I'm carrying, the Architecture 2030 bill. There is a revolving loan bill that Senator Rosen is carrying, and there's a lease purchase loan program that Senator Dibble is carrying.
There's a title now, I guess. Can you tell us the title of that bill again?
The name of PB.
I heard there's a title.
Public Buildings Energy Buildings, Efficient, yes. Enhanced Energy Efficiency Program.
Public Buildings.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, we refer to it as PBEEP.
Yeah, PB.
Yeah. That bill has a title. It's arrived. All right.
The information is very helpful, and it helps us, too, as we move forward and try to figure out how we implement a process and a way of measuring and meeting our goals. So, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what I heard from Senator Kelly's wrap-up was that probably if we were to rank order priority, the opportunities or challenges that we have, probably the first one is someone's got to come up with the money. So hence the Senator Rosen's bill, my bill, and some other ideas that are out there. And we need to figure out a way to amortize that, of course. We're not blowing budgets out of the water. But someone needs to come up with the money initially to make the changes or to address the gap. What would be the second and third in terms of I'm taking this. I'll take a guess, and we'll see if I got it. One that I heard come from the report that you just presented is it's kind of knowledge and just that capacity around knowledge and information about what's possible, what can be done in buildings. And the other is this issue around metrics and how we measure what we're trying to fix. That actually surprised me quite a bit, because I thought the B3 database. Well, first of all, there's a lack of measuring and lack of uniformity in how we measure, which is a real surprise, because I thought the B3 database kind of got to that. So am I getting in the ballpark in terms of like second and third priorities?
Senator Dibble, certainly I would view those as in the top five. I think the other point I would like to emphasize is this notion of treating these entities as an enterprise. We have a tendency to think of the state agencies as one enterprise, the U of M is another, MNSCU is a third, and we haven't even talked about school districts, cities, and counties yet. So finding some way to knit the state enterprises together, whether it's through sharing energy credits or other kinds of things, so that everybody sees themselves on the same team with respect to achieving these goals, is very important and would help the state achieve some efficiencies on the energy, on the information point that you were talking about, Senator Dibble, where if each of those three entities is developing and sort of hoarding their own knowledge gains with respect to how to do this, that's not serving the whole state. So finding some way, whether it's through the Department of Administration, to see the enterprises all together, I think is a very important strategy. And I don't know if Nikki, from the department's point of view, has anything to add, and then we
Madam Chair, members, I would just add one thing to Senator, or former Senator Kelly's comments there. It is not a conscious decision to not share data, and I think I can speak on behalf of Minsky and the U of M there. Certainly it is not with state agencies. It's just a tough nugget to crack when you each are sitting in front of different committees. You have different programmatic needs in each of the departments. There are many roadblocks in our way. But I will comment that one initiative that the Department of Administration on behalf of all of the state agencies is finally getting at through the Drive to Excellence is the whole idea of a real property governance and a real property common database type system for facilities. That is, in fact, moving us in the right direction. We're just at the initial steps of that. But I see great potential in that, and if there was any way to force more forums between the three sectors, I'm all for it in the Department of Administration. I think what we can share is great. We just don't have that many opportunities to do it.
Senator Carlson.
Now, Madam Chair, and I think Senator Kelly, I guess I'm wondering about how much pushback you're getting, and I think I got the answer here. And one of the things that I keep thinking is we must have a lot of architects on staff in the state. And I would think that that's one of the places to really start also is architects, because architects are the ones that specify how a building works and what types of uses of energy are inside of it. And you know, we don't even have to leave the room here. When you look at the 24 bulbs that are up here, and how they don't light the room at all. All they do is add heat. And that heat, now it's fine at a day like this, but in the summertime, that heat has to be expensively removed from this building. So what we're doing is, a lot of times, we're bringing all sorts of energy into these buildings, and all energy turns into heat eventually, and then it has to be removed. So our heating and our air conditioning is probably the low-hanging fruit in a lot of places. That you know, certainly building heating and insulation is one of the things that we can work on. But first thing I think is, you know, how would we get rid of the architecturally attractive things in this capital that use a lot of energy? And until we figure that out, I don't know that we're really serious about it yet.
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, I think you're exactly right. And in addition to the need to train more architects, I would emphasize the point Ms. Mallett made about building operators and engineers. Jerome Malmquist at the university made a point that struck me, which was that they have a number of projects that have five-year paybacks that they haven't been able to do because there are an insufficient number of well-trained project managers who could implement those. So the barrier in that case is a person barrier, of folks with the right kind of training to do this. Now we're making, as more and more architects, engineers, designers become familiar with the energy savings potential and techniques to do it, we're making progress. But here again, it's another point where seeing the enterprise as one piece, Minsky in its energy management role for its buildings plays one role, but Minsky is also a primary trainer of a lot of the people who could carry out this work. So I think I do certainly encourage as much cooperation by this committee with the higher ed committee and with state government operations to find ways to bridge some of these divisions and create some synergy with these solutions.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Kelly. I'd like to work with your team on one thing. I have a bill, actually, that I think will pass this year, my Business Accountability Act. We're creating an inventory form for cities to use with businesses, but I think we could use a version of that for state and city buildings as well. You know, I heard mentioned you can't really manage what you can't count. So if we can figure out how to inventory it, but I was kind of wondering out loud to this committee, too, under some of our efficiency rulings or rules, laws, I'm kind of wondering if we can't work with power companies, gas companies, in terms of having them retrofit for meters and giving them a credit under our efficiency program. So maybe there's an impetus for them to actually come in and retrofit the buildings with metering devices and things, and they can get the credit, and it wouldn't cost a taxpayer. And as you talked, Senator Kelly, about the one enterprise, and it always troubles me when I hear people going over and over again about, well, it costs this much more to make it energy efficient. So somehow we need to factor within our statutes that when that goes out to bid, it doesn't cost the taxpayer more. In fact, you just cost the taxpayer more by not building in those efficiencies up front. So somehow we've skewed the system ourselves in terms of bidding and the process. And I always refer to a LEED certified school building we have in Elk River that it will have a quick payback. It's showed the differences, and it's a tremendous difference in operating costs versus the same square footage elementary school in the same district. So we have good comparisons out there to show that. So I hope you'll work with us in trying to figure out how do we manage that, how do we change our statute, how do we change the bidding so we're not saying we're going to forego the energy efficiency because we may have paid for that second lab two or three times over just by loss of energy efficiency.
Well, and Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer.
Senator Kelly.
I've been thinking hard about the bonding dynamics because energy savings investments reduce future cash flow demands. But we, and the legislature's in this debate with the governor now, regarding the 3% debt service limit. And if you could if there was some way to recognize the energy savings investment as a reduction to future, in effect, a reduction to future debt service or to cash flow related to that, there's a relationship there which our current financing techniques don't enable us to recognize. And that's one area where we would encourage further study, where you ought to engage, I think, the Department of Finance in helping to think through how to do this. Because certainly the Conservation Improvement Program investments with respect to measurement are a positive thing. And the Department of Commerce is working on ways to, particularly for campuses that are outside the service territory of CenterPoint or Xcel Energy, individual utilities haven't had the resources to invest in a significant conservation improvement project on those campuses. But if those smaller utilities can aggregate their CIP obligations and therefore make significant chunks available to particularly Minsky campuses, I think a lot of progress could be made there. But if the state, using third-party financing, you're paying somebody else a profit on their financing service. So if the more of this that the state of Minnesota can finance, the better off taxpayers are in the long run.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Jungbauer, I think you hit on the one key word here is accountability. That's, to me, and it's one thing to, as we go forward and we're developing or constructing new buildings, that we build in these energy efficiencies, but the vast array of buildings that we've identified that are already there that we need to deal with, and it's the way we operate those buildings or identify the efficiencies within them. And as we're going through some of these other areas of reform here at the legislature, I'm thinking of healthcare in particular right now. We're talking about transparency and things like that. And I'm looking at some of the suggestions. One would be a championship award or something for energy savings. But to do that, we need to have, you know, some sort of transparency on how we're doing, and not only for those that are the champions, but those that aren't doing as well, so that we can, you know, encourage those building operators or those institutions that have, you know, not doing well for whatever reason, can be identified, and others can see that and maybe apply some peer pressure of sorts to say we need to move forward, but with a lack of either measurements to be able to do that, or a forum that we can publish this data, that we won't be able to move forward on that. But that accountability measure, I think, is extremely important here.
I think some of this is going on. At least I'm aware of it in my community, where the governor has acknowledged a building like the deck for its being environmentally designed, I guess, and because of all the energy efficient measures that they've taken, as well as some buildings on the Minsku campuses and UMD, and they've taken out full-page ads to acknowledge this. So the other businesses then become aware of this. And I know that the Duluth Clinic also had a high-energy efficient addition that was put on. And so this becomes then something that other businesses recognize and they aspire to also. I think, Ms. Mallett, you wish to add something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. committee. I just wanted to say I think it's a very valid point. The importance of accountability and transparency and sort of having a criteria where it's laid out. And so one suggestion we had is with respect to the LEED certification. This is a leadership in energy and environmental design. And basically one challenge is that there's a fee to get a certificate of, I believe it's $100,000. And so what one suggestion is, as opposed to spending money on that actual $100,000, just having the building actually meet the LEED requirements, even if it's not LEED certified, but it is one way to demonstrate success or energy savings.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I was wondering if we could just hear a little bit more about the subject of failure. It's kind of picking up off of Senator Dahl's question. This fact that we're not measuring energy use in the same way with the same metrics across all. I mean, I'm actually very surprised to hear that, because I thought we had some standardized way of measuring that. And the other is, these 1 or 2 meters for 20 buildings. How does the effort to document all of the public buildings in the state and their relative energy use and opportunities there, how does that B3 database effort deal with that subject?
Mr. McFarland.
Madam Chair, committee. There really is a diversity of reporting. What we found in requesting monthly and annual energy data from all of the agencies and entities was that they... it was quite an effort for them to find their data. First of all, they weren't really keeping track of it. Most of the data came from utility bills. Many of the utilities use, say, cubic feet for heat. Some use BTU. Others might use joules or there's a few other ways to measure heat energy. Some of it may vary by source, but all of those different units are easily converted to one standard unit, primarily BTUs. Electricity is usually kilowatt hours, so there's probably no challenge there. The thing we really saw, though, was that it was the utilities who really could keep track of the energy data, but not the facilities managers, whether that's because of the contract with the utilities or the construction of the buildings and the meters. That would probably vary site by site. But simply requesting each facilities manager to keep track of monthly or energy, monthly or annual energy data, whether reading the meter themselves or asking the utility to report back to them, it would probably only be an hour a month of their work, probably less than an hour. And asking them to convert it to a standard energy unit would be very easy. You could simply give them a standardized calculation in which to submit their data, and it would convert very easily. As for the B3 database, I believe it's always expanding. It's not universal yet. I believe on page, let me find it.
18.
I think it's page 17. Page 17 has table 2.2. It has estimated annual energy consumption emissions. Only probably three or four of these came from the B3 database. The other agencies and campuses, we had to compile from their own energy data. So while the B3 database might be expanding, it definitely did not cover all of these. Additionally, these were minimal estimates. It's likely that these numbers are higher, but since we did not have sufficient data, we could not find a specific baseline. The B3 database keeps track of buildings and many of their energy factors, but I don't believe it has a consistent database of monthly or annual energy consumption.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have several questions. There are other certifications besides LEED, is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Senator Kelly, would the third-party financing, would that be similar to what the school districts are doing with their energy conservation?
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I think the answer would be districts probably use a variety of techniques. Certainly some would self-finance some projects, but for a period of time we've had guaranteed energy savings authorization for school districts and for local governments. And so in that, all of the costs, including the financing costs, are bundled into the contract price that the unit of government pays to the contractor to do the work. So if the understanding is that the contractor does the work, district doesn't pay, the contractor gets paid out of the guaranteed energy savings over time, but the price that the contractor charges includes its cost of purchasing financing in the private market. And since the public generally can borrow at cheaper prices than a private entity can, it's certainly a useful source of financing for cash-strapped governments, but when you think about it as a financing mechanism, you have to recognize that there's a cost disadvantage on the interest side for financing energy savings projects in that way.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Well, Senator Kelly, I just want to applaud yourself and your team. I think this is exciting, and I'm going to sit down and read the whole thing. I think it's fascinating. And I believe what Senator Jungbauer and Senator Dibble and Senator Dahl mentioned about the accountability and establishing that baseline, I think that's, would you agree that's the first step that we need to do is establish that baseline?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, one of the good things about the work that the legislature has been doing with the governor on energy is spending a lot of time and being very clear about goals and spending enough time so that all of you understand those, have a consistent understanding of those goals. And so I think additional effort is needed to have the same degree of consistent understanding about what the baseline is, what the goal ought to be, and how we're going to measure progress to that goal with respect to energy savings in public buildings. And we think the foundation has been well laid, but it's the kind of work that only the legislature is in a position to do in terms of consulting with all the players and then coming to a consensus about the approach you're going to use.
And Madam Chair, Senator Rose?
I'm sorry. One more question. That leads me to my last question, Senator Kelly, about the goal enforcement with an audit or some kind of independent energy audit. Have you thought more down the road on that issue?
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, this would certainly need more work because one idea that we talked about and tried out with various participants in the study process was the notion of creating sort of energy savings credits that would be comparable to carbon credits. And the reason for doing that is sort of back to my point about treating the enterprise as a whole. Every time I think about this, I think that the Department of Corrections is going to have a hard time achieving year after year, 1.5% absolute savings, because there's only so much efficiency you can get out of the existing prison building stock and a new prison, and unfortunately the population of prisoners is tending to go up over time. So even if they get more efficient with respect to each prisoner that they're housing, getting an absolute reduction in the Department of Corrections may be a big challenge. But if there's a way to recognize that other agencies are in a position to get much more savings and have a way of recognizing that across agencies over time by the transfer of credits, that's a possible way of seeing the enterprise as a whole and having this be sustainable over time. But it's a complicated, how you would set it up would be complicated, and you don't want to do any harm. And we think that the agency managers are motivated to do the right thing, but they're balancing their mission, their program mission, with this energy savings mission. And so some step by the legislature to help build energy savings into their sort of long-term mission picture is an important step. We have some ideas about how that could be done, but that one requires a lot more thinking.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Senator Anderson talks a lot about having a green bonding bill that would allow, you know, institutions or state facilities to have a geothermal system and be willing to pay for it, because it seems like they always get cut off as budgets get, or the bonding bill gets cut back. But my question is, when Senator Rosen was speaking earlier on the third-party financing, and you addressed that, on page 67 it talks about the University of Minnesota Twin City campus, that they indicate that the financial office does not approve third-party financing as it can potentially affect the bond rating of their campus. I don't quite understand why that would affect a bond rating.
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, here's my understanding, and we didn't explore that further with the financial office at the university, so it's a question that we could get additional information for you on. But I think it's partly related to the point I was making about the price of financing. In a way, it's not prudent for the U to pay a third-party contractor to go out and borrow money to do something for the U when the university's own borrowing rate is much lower than the typical private entity would be. And that cash flow that the university owes the contractor related to the savings is another encumbrance on its cash flow that could be incorporated into the bond rating calculations made by the rating agencies. So I think those are the two factors that go into that.
Any further questions or comments? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Kelly, you mentioned the $3 million that the University of Minnesota had set aside. Was that something that was through bonding, or how did they set aside the $3 million?
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I think it was a case where the energy management went to the administration and said, we need a mechanism for protecting energy savings money from program needs. And then the administration went to the region. My understanding was a policy adopted by the regents to set aside that money for energy savings purposes. And we suggest that as an analogy for whether it's the green bonding bill concept or something the legislature could do to create a pool of money that entities could draw on for both energy savings features in new buildings and energy retrofits of existing buildings.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. I was going to get back to the 1.5% annual savings, and just going to ask, where does the lack of clarity arise that you reported on? Because I think the bill, in terms of the overall goals of the bill from last year, are pretty clear with respect to the goals that we set forth for utilities. And it's kind of annualized, rolling 1.5%. It's not absolute. We're going to come down 1.5%, but we're going to recognize that the economy, the population, everybody's going to grow. It's 1.5% savings from what would have been otherwise, and that's, you know, we.
Well,
Senator Kelly
and Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, it's both in our thinking about this and the conversation we had. The IPCC recommendations for achieving greenhouse gas reductions are absolute. They're not controlled. They're not, you know, growth accepted. And so if the state is going to be, and part of this is sort of how we approach it, and we heard similar points of view, but there were also different points of view among the different participants who gave us information. But I think the sense is that if the state is going to achieve its portion of the IPCC goals, we're going to have an absolute savings, not a, you know, measured in some sense, not a rolling controlled for growth or energy intensity approach to this. I mean, because you could have if you said we're going to make sure that Minnesota state government entities use 1.5% each year less energy per person in Minnesota that we're serving. You know, if the state grew, you wouldn't get an absolute reduction, but you'd have you'd have increased energy intensity, increased energy efficiency. So we think the unlike the utilities, where what you're trying to do is control behavior indirectly, with respect to public entities, you have direct control over the end user. And so the question is, are you going to put a high target out there for the end user or a soft target?
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Well, then I would like to thank you very much. Your report was very informative. All of the reports have been informative today, and we appreciate it. Tomorrow we will meet in the same room at 3 o'clock, and at that time we'll have a discussion about transmission issues. And there have been a number of issues that are standing in the way of our renewable energy standard and getting that out there. So it's important that you all come and hear what's going on, too. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.
Good job.